Talk given Saturday, 25th March, 1972. The perfected holy ones through the ages have always been the awakeners of men. Their whole life effort, an example, and their influence has worked in order to release us out of the dualistic, worldly consciousness, caught and confined within the sphere of ambivalence, continuously in a state of conflict, out of that into the pure awareness of the unconditioned, of the transcendent. A pure awareness, which does not mean just expending one's energy in trying to forcibly hold the thought, the idea of transcendence or the unconditioned in our minds. Because every thought or idea is false, it's a false picture, it's a distorted picture of the reality. It will come quite naturally and it will emerge quite naturally, the thought. But we must let that pass by. We mustn't grasp at that. The awareness of the unconditioned means that one is the unconditioned. You are it. You don't need to know it in the ordinary sense of knowing, namely the observing subject looking at an external observed object. Because obviously the unconditioned, the transcendent, can never be an object of perception. It is very important first to get the idea of all this. And having got the idea of it, let the idea be transformed into the living feel of it. And the living feel can just become second nature, so that one is unconscious of it in terms of intellectual knowledge. And being unconscious of it in terms of intellectual knowledge, one is in a state of ease inwardly. One is at home with transcendence. Now that awareness permeates one's whole being and affects one's whole life. Our mental states, our emotional uprisings and so forth, all come and they all go. But this pure awareness, this unconditioned reality, has no beginning nor ending. It is timeless. Now it is this awareness which throws out all kinds of shapes in the process of our daily living, which unquestionably is in the conditioned sphere, in the dualistic sphere, in the sphere of ambivalence. But the influence of this pure awareness will be one which harmonizes the opposites. The duals are no longer in conflict, and we, in our psychical life and functioning, do not fall into the trap of taking sides with one of the ambivalents against the other. When we cease to take sides of the one against the other, when subjection to preferential choice is out, then the mind is in that state of peace and purity which enables us truly to understand all that happens. Otherwise, there is no possibility of real understanding. That understanding which has the power to transmute the whole of the becoming process as it enters us and goes out of us, charged with our reactions, if any. We'd have no possibility of transmuting that whole becoming process into the perfect thing that it is intended to be. This is the sort of activity which the perfected holy ones fulfill in supreme measure, especially when they are in deep meditation. Now, when they are not in deep meditation, the ordinary life process is necessarily concerned with, and the attention is directed to, the passing becoming process. Now, in this connection, we might consider something which the Buddha taught, which is of extraordinary depth and significance, but whose depth and significance cannot be seen just in the words in which they are couched, which this particular teaching is couched. In fact, it always passes over our heads. I know it passed over mine for, nearly 30 years. And now, at last, I'm beginning to sort of penetrate into, through the fringes of the extraordinary truth that is embodied in these words. You know how time and again, when some Brahman or one of his own disciples or somebody came to him and had a conversation, the texts say that in so and so there arose the spotless vision of truth. And that spotless vision of truth is expressed in these simple words: whatsoever hath a beginning, that by nature hath an ending. For example, I've got the original Pali of the long discourses. This is one of the very famous discourses. Well, they all are rather wonderful, but this is specially wonderful in so many ways, which we needn't go into now. Pokkarasadi, the Brahman, has come to see the Buddha, meet him, and the Buddha speaks to him, gives what is called a graduated talk, talks about the simple things first. And then, when the Buddha sees that Pokkarasadi's mind has become soft and malleable, and ready to receive the highest teaching, then he reveals to him what the Buddhas have won, namely the truth of ill, the truth of the cause of ill, of dukkha, the truth of the extinction of ill and the way to the extinction of that ill. And so at the end, It says how Pokharasadi, Tasmin yeva asane virajam vitamalam dhammachakkum udapadi. Yang kinchi samudaya dhammam sabbang tang nirodha dhammam ti. Now it means this. And then in Pokharasadi, even as he sat there, the stainless, spotless eye of vision of the truth of the Dhamma, the Dhammachakku, Udapadi, uprose. And he saw that whatsoever hath a beginning, that by nature hath an ending. Now, of course, superficially we may say, well, everybody knows that. Whosoever is born must necessarily die. A tree grows and someday it will perish. What is there so marvelous about that? Of course, if we look at it from the purely material aspect, there is nothing marvelous about it. Nothing at all. Anybody knows that. A little child comes to know that very soon. He had a little pet which he played with, and perhaps it got run over, or it died a natural death, and so it passed away. So what's there? Why does it need an enlightened one to tell even a little child such a simple thing? But what is the Buddha referring to? What is he concerned with? Is he concerned with the process of the world in material terms? Not at all. He was quite unconcerned with that. He noticed it, he saw it, he was far more sensitively aware of it than I am, or any ordinary person is. What was he concerned with? As he himself said, he was a mind healer. It is mind which essentially distinguishes man from the other kingdoms of nature. It is in the mind that our awareness and our knowledge of the world arises. It is in our own minds that it progresses, it proceeds, it grows, it regresses, it suffers, it enjoys, and so forth. And it is in the mind that it comes to an end. Material things may uprise in our minds because our senses convey the fact and existence of that material thing to us. But when our attention has been drawn away or has ceased to be given to it, then, although that material thing continues to exist, it has vanished out of our minds. That is the ending of it. The perishing of it. It may rise up again and it may perish again. But that is not of great importance. What is of importance are the mental states, the psychological states into which we enter. Continuously through our life, there is a ceaseless succession of psychological states. A ceaseless succession. Now these psychological states, in the what the Buddha would have called the ordinary worldly man, are states which deal with and are often controlled by and to which one reacts, concerned with the ordinary material everyday life, the things to do, the daily chores and so forth, our ambitions and our activities and our pleasure drives and all the rest of it. But even in the case of those who seek to live the holy life, who have a vision of purpose, meaning, significance in human life, who have some sort of feel towards human fruition and perfection, even they get caught in the trap of believing that the particular state of mind into which they entered in deep meditation, particularly in deep meditation, is something which is permanent, that this is it. Now the Buddha points out that this is not it. Howsoever wonderful the state of mind of consciousness may be, it has uprisen, and because it has uprisen, it will come to an end. Because whatsoever uprises, begins, exists in time, not in the timeless. Exists by virtue of so many conditions which determine the uprising of this particular state. As long as those conditions hold, the state will continue. But the conditions never hold permanently. They never do. They are constantly changing. Therefore, the state itself will undergo disruption. Now, when it undergoes disruption, what happens to the person who is grasping after a particular state because he has found satisfaction, exaltation, peace, comfort in that state? He is once again miserable. And he seeks to bring it back. Profound error. Perhaps a less profound error, he seeks for the opportunity to make a similar state come up again. But this is not nirvana. This is not the state of dispassion, of cessation, of that sublime, unoriginated peace, which indeed is nirvana. So you see, when one really understands, one truly perceives, as if it were the light of the sun itself, that whatsoever state uprises within one, that state by nature will cease to be. Now, what is the consequence of really seeing that? Then one ceases to grasp. That root quality, which is the source of man's misery in the world, greed, is out. The whole of greed is out when one has really seen that. Then one takes everything in one's stride. One takes everything in one's stride easily because one doesn't take it in one's stride. You get the point? One just stands still, in fact, and lets the whole becoming process go through and past one. And that pure awareness, which is the unconditioned state that man and man alone can realize, is the permanent reality within oneself. That is the timeless, that is the eternal, that is the indescribable, that is that which cannot be confined, which is out of the realm of mortality. You see the importance of it. If that grasping after this condition, that state, this desirable goal, and so forth, If all grasping after these things is really out, then oneself is the true human. We can go back to that marvelous teaching in the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad as to the meaning of the person, the Purusha, he in whom all evil-mindedness is completely burnt out. And what a burning out! Here is the rough ore, myself as I am. But in this burning out, not only is it a case of merely the pure gold being left, but all that was dross is also converted into pure gold. You see, that is the Holy One, the person, the Purusha, in the real sense. Not a personality, but the person. So we can go back to that and see that that is the state of nirvana. That is the state of the unconditioned, the one in whom all evil-mindedness is burnt out. Because the root source of it all, which keeps us confined, namely greed, possessiveness, to hold back, to concretize that which is the unconditioned and the absolute, this is the thing that is actually suffering, the meaning of the word suffering in the spiritual sense. Now you will also see why we start at the morality end of the story, why we start dealing with tanha, craving, greed. And we do not start with attempting to get rid of delusion, of ignorance. If we try to get rid of ignorance, we invariably fall, we slide into the morass of acquiring knowledge, collecting ideas, thinking that thereby we are removing our ignorance. We are not doing anything of the sort. This is the religious context, the context of transcendence, of the spirit, the infinite, the immeasurable, the qualityless acquisition. Any sort of acquisition is a bondage, is a burden, is a defilement. Wisdom, the pure state, is the one of pristine nakedness, of the absolute that which actually is. Nothing acquired. So if we acquire knowledge, all that we do is to pile up a mountainous burden upon our heads with that knowledge. The acquisition of knowledge has its place, its indispensable place in the world of affairs. It has no place where the liberation of the spirit is concerned, where the utter purification of the psyche and of its fruition into the state in which all evil-mindedness is burnt out is concerned. No place there. We must have knowledge for the daily business of the world physically, and so forth. We must have knowledge for the sake of the, and the necessity for, the workings of the intellect. And the intellect can work only within the sphere of duality, in the sphere of choice. One accepts this and sees that this is better or worse than that, which is obviously true. But this is all, therefore, in the realm of the limited, the finite, the particular. It is in the realm of the mortal, where there is an uprising and an inevitable deceasing. But he who wants to escape the noose of death, sorry, I use the bad word, escape, he who wants to be released out of the noose of death must understand that whatsoever uprises of necessity perishes, it is under the overlordship of death. And therefore he ceases to grasp at anything at all. Ceasing to grasp, himself and everything are one great harmony. That tremendous delusion of our innermost consciousness, which makes us think and direct our energies and act in terms of self and not self, that delusion is out. And the pure light of the Spirit permeates the whole, and there is no difference between self and not self. That strange, pathetic conceit meaning fanciful notion, of an I separate from you, or that, or it, is out. And in that there is peace, and in that there is nirvana. That is the fulfillment of man, the state which is the fulfillment of man. Nothing which a man gets or grasps. As we put it in theistic religions, unto God the glory, for man, for me, the separate individual, nothing at all. We are the instruments through which the light of the Spirit sets on fire its own manifestation. Will that fire give out smoke, or will it shed light and life and joy all around? That is our responsibility. That depends upon us. And the perfected holy ones were concerned with this. They had found the way, as they said. And they realized that after having found the way, they had to give up the way. They had to let go of the way, cease to grasp the way. Why? Essentially because themselves, they are living beings, were the actual way. I see, it seems to me that something like this lies hidden in the depths of those few words which come up in the Buddhist texts. And in so and so, the stainless vision of truth arose, and he saw, even as he sat there, that whatsoever hath a beginning, by nature hath an ending. What an extraordinary influence the perfected Holy One has upon human beings. One can see how easily and naturally men ascribe divine authority to such a man. But having ascribed it and having felt with reverence the holiness which they have had the good fortune to witness, they fall into the mistake of crystallizing that authority in words, in ideas, in doctrines, in dogmas. And though perhaps perfunctorily they say, these are only the words don't get attached to them, the fact remains that they themselves and all their followers do get attached to the words. And before long, the words have become the tombs of truth. They are rigid death, holding life in bondage. We have to find release out of all that, out of all that. Not by discarding it, not by throwing it away. We have to take those rigid forms and transmute them. Not merely revivify them, but utterly transmute them in our own being. If we throw away those forms, what do we do in actuality? We immediately burden ourselves with other forms. Oh, I didn't like the Marxist-Leninist philosophy. Ah, but I liked the National Socialist philosophy. Therefore, I gave up communism and became a Nazi. I didn't like this, but I like the philosophy of the Liberal Party, or whatever it is. And so one jumps about, you know, from branch to branch like a monkey, with not even a tenth of the natural wisdom of that monkey, which enables it to know exactly where to jump and how to jump. He never falls. But we have lost the skill of the monkey, and we fall every time whenever we jump. And we fall into a stinking morass. You see, the stench of the life of men in the world. Look at the cruelty, the murder, the stupidity, the evil that is continuously generated everywhere. In forms which are pleasure-giving to so many or pain-giving to so many. And they are all seeking more pleasure all the time. When they sacrifice themselves for the sake of a great cause, in order to bring about a future which will usher in the millennium for their people, whenever they attempt to do that, you see the way they tread. The ways that they tread. They are the ways of violence, of destructiveness, of hate, of egoism, of vanity, and above all, of extraordinarily destructive stupidity. The utter denial of humanity through it all. Is it any wonder that the history of the world is what it is, has been what it is? They refuse to face the truth about themselves. Whatsoever uprises in their mind and in their desire, they grasp and want to fulfill, instead of knowing that it will die. They refuse to face the truth about themselves. And therefore they want to impose with the utmost brutality often their will, their evil will upon the becoming process. And look at the cost to mankind. There is no escape. There is no release from suffering, from going the wrong way. If they were to face themselves, look within, and understand the truth of their own being and nature, the right ways will emerge out of their innermost consciousness. Then they will see that only the great transcendent values can be the mainsprings of human action. Transcendent love, wisdom, goodness, beauty, all these things. But if transcendent goodness is to emerge, its basis inevitably of necessity must be the simple moralities. And note the simple moralities, how they have been taught. Brahmanism, Hinduism, Buddhism, Christianity, Jesus' own words, look at them. They all teach this. In thought and feeling, in word and in deed, abstain from all harming. From all harming. Abstain from harming in thought and feeling. It's not a light task. It takes a hero. It takes a hero with a giant strength in order to fulfill such a thing. In thought and feeling. Whilst we have control over our hands, and we can refrain, forcibly prevent ourselves from performing a cruel, a harsh act. What of the mind? The reaction is instantaneous. And we are conscious of having harmed in our feeling and in our thought only after we have done the deed. Whereas where the body is concerned, we are conscious before the deed is actually done. Therefore, we have a chance to refrain from harming. But this is how what they taught. In thought and feeling, essentially and primarily, in speech and in deed, to refrain from harming, to refrain from taking what is not freely given, what is not a love gift. Refrain from taking what is not a love gift. If I am an employer, then if I am to live by that, when I pay a salary or the wage to my employee, I give it as a love gift. Not as a barter based upon strict, calculated reciprocity. If you do 8 hours work and produce that much, then I will give you this. And if you don't, I feel very hateful towards you. Not that way. And it is the same with any and every human interchange, where, of course, giving and taking necessarily goes on. We go to a shop to buy our food. Let us give the money as a love gift. Let them give what they have to give as a love gift. No grasping is involved there. No evil is done there in thought and feeling or in deed. Refrain in thought and feeling and speech and deed from all sense indulgence. Indulgence, not the right use of the senses. there must of necessity be the right use of the senses. In fact, it is essential to develop our sensitivities to the utmost. And when our sensitivities develop to the utmost, we are conscious of the pleasurable aspect of sensation as well as the displeasurable aspect of sensation to a degree far greater than that of the worldly man. We take in everything and we absorb everything in totality. That is being sensitive and using the senses rightly. But when we indulge the senses, because we take sides through preferential choice with this type of sensation against that type of sensation, in order that we may satisfy our greed for a certain type of pleasure, then we are squandering divine energy. That type of enjoyment inevitably brings about the squandering of energy. That is why to put it in the usual way, there is always that horrible morning after the night before feeling, after indulgence of the senses. But the right use of the senses, it's a very different thing. There is no grasping in the process of the right use of the senses. You see, with sense indulgence, there is a wastage of energy, of something which is given to us by Mother Nature as an investment, as a bequest, of inestimable value and worth, and we misuse it. You see, the holy ones were not killjoys. On the contrary, they showed us how we may so understand things and so discipline ourselves that our joy in existence as it is, the becoming process as it flows past, may be even greater than the joy of the stupid person who doesn't know how to use his senses rightly. And then again, to refrain in speech from all untruthful speech, malicious, gossipy, slanderous, harsh, and so forth. Now all these things constitute the simple basic morality in order that transcendent goodness may be one of the ways by which we live. And the same with truth, with wisdom, with beauty. If we are utterly free of all vanity and separative egoism, then we will begin to understand what is the meaning of beauty. When one's heart is pure, ungrasping, and one's eyes are perfectly clean and true seeing, then you will experience something quite extraordinary. Whatsoever you see, which by the dualistic standards of the world is called beautiful or ugly, by this transcendent standard, everything is seen as a manifestation of beauty. The beauty which has no definition, no standards, no criteria. That beauty of all beauty, which is the life power of the infinite, flowering out. You will surely, time and again, come across this experience. When you just happen to be In that state of quietness, of inward peace and beatitude, with your mind and heart in the ungrasping state, you will find that you will see beauty in everything, whether it is terribly hurtful or whether it is pleasant. This is true. This happens. And you will also experience this when that happens. There will be no antagonistic criticism. You might see a drunken man, and you know what a horrible sight he can be, lurching along, being sick all over the pavement, and so forth. And yet, this sense of transcendent beauty will enable you to see it and see its place in the becoming process. And this other thing which you will notice, when you see with the eye of beauty like that, you will also see with the eye of compassion. You will know what the Mahakaruna of the Buddhist means. This Mahakaruna will not affect that drunken man in his ill state at the moment. But it will certainly affect you, who are the focus through which this transcendent energy flows out. It will transform your being even more and more, making you into the likeness of that perfection which is true humanness, the state of the Son of Man who is identical with the Son of God, the Manasaputra who is the same as the Brahmaputra. It will transform you. And maybe that in that transforming of our own self, an energy goes out which may well affect the whole environment for its good. We don't know. It is not for us to measure. You will also experience the reality of that peace and that freedom which is present because in inner consciousness you are awake to the fact, without any words or thoughts attached to it, of the fact, of the truth, that whatsoever uprises by nature has a decease. What then, amongst other things, happens in oneself, the individual? In such states, one lives in the timeless. And if one doesn't grasp at the state by becoming discriminatively conscious of it, this is the thing you have to beware of. Don't become discriminatively conscious of it. If one doesn't grasp at that state, the next state which inevitably emerges out of the old state and the prevailing conditions will also be in terms of timelessness in your inner consciousness. Understand this, and you will really begin to understand at least those words of the Buddha when he talks to Aggivesana. And he says, and then Aggivesana, I enter into that state which is the Shunyata Phala Samadhi, the fruit of the void, the state of the voidness. in which I constantly abide. It is the state of nirvana, in which I constantly abide. But he doesn't abide in it consciously, desirously. He abides in that state naturally. And whilst he is in that state, he gives out his teaching to anybody and everybody. Because the perfected Holy One is one who has realized, made real in his own being, the extraordinary truth which to understand is right beyond all thinking and investigating purely mentally, namely that the void is the emptiness which contains the whole plenitude of energy and the manifestations, the innumerable manifestations of that energy. We don't know it in the ordinary way. We can know it, however, by being in such states which afterwards, when we come back to the functioning of discriminative consciousness and the activity of memory, the pure memory, enables us to say that yes, this void is the container of the plenitude. And further, you will know, you will just know that void and plenitude are not two separates. They are one and the same, they are identical. You see what is implied in the living of the holy life. This blissful movement, activity, in stillness, in non-movement. Which enables one to be unconditioned. According to the ways of the world, we just remain the ordinary man in the world. The perfected Holy One sitting in the marketplace is just an interesting looking fellow sitting in the marketplace. Or he may not at all be interesting looking. He may be quite like a nobody. And everybody passes by and hardly gives him a glance, or if he gives him a glance, and he passes on, just like that. But you see, the selfless one is the naturally self-effaced one. And in that is his security. He doesn't arouse anybody's envy or call forth anybody's malice or ill will. He just is so harmless that the becoming process in blissful blindness and ignorance just flows on and leaves him utterly unscathed. The eternal perfection embodied in the midst of the imperfect. This is the marvel of the holy life. But you see, this marvel can never be unless greed, as Sariputta said, is extinguished. Unless hate is extinguished, delusion has vanished, and all that there is the pure light of transcendent realization.